more than 200 years ago. For NPR News, I'm Stuart Cohen in Sydney.
California is poised to vote on a new set of fuel mileage and emissions standards for cars. They would mandate cars produce about three-quarters less smog-producing pollutants and get strikingly better mileage by 2025. Michael Coates of Western Auto Journalists says future vehicles might look a lot different than today's cars as engineers and designers work to meet higher standards.
It's going to be a challenge for industry to meet the 54.5 miles per gallon. It's not going to be easy, and it will change the vehicles that we have. It's going to change the engines. It may change the fuels.
But a state air resources official says automakers appear more receptive to this round of clean air standards than they've been to earlier ones. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Vanderbilt University Medical Center, working to make genome-driven cancer care the next standard at vanderbilthealth.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
You depend on WILL for comprehensive news and thought-provoking commentary. And WILL depends on you for more than 40% of its operating budget. Beginning February 9th, we hope to encourage at least 400 listeners to support WILL with a pledge call. Or you could give online now at willpledge.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, both hours of the program come from the Focus Archives. They are both shows that we first broadcast last October, so we hope that you will enjoy listening. Perhaps this will be the first time that you've heard the programs. We'll be back on our schedule with live shows tomorrow. But for this morning, for both hours, we'll not be taking calls. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about the life and death of an American president, James Garfield. In the summer of 1881, James Garfield was shot by a deranged assassin named Charles Guiteau. Now, initially, he was fortunate in that the wounds were not serious enough to kill him outright. In fact, today, Garfield would probably have spent a few days in the hospital. Even if his doctors had done nothing about his wounds, chances are that he would have survived. However, Garfield ended up dying from an infection that was caused by his own medical team. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Candace Millard about the life and death of James Garfield, a man that she argues, had he lived, might have been regarded as one of our best, or at least among the best, of our presidents. She writes about this story in a book that's just recently come out. The title is Destiny of the Republic, and the subtitle is A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. Doubleday is the publisher. Candace Millard is the author of another book, a bestseller. That book is The River of Doubt, which was about a trip that Teddy Roosevelt made in 1912 down the Amazon. Got a lot of favorable attention, was named Best Book of the Year by the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post Book World, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Christian Science Monitor, other publications. The new book is just out, and she's spending time talking about it, and we're glad that she could be with us. And Ms. Millard, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm great. Thank
Good.
You.
Thank you. It's a fascinating book, a remarkable story. It is, again, one of those cases where I was really pleased to have the chance to explore it, because before this, I don't think I could have told you much of anything about James Garfield other than the fact that, well, he was shot. And it was just a few months into his term. So, you know, no one really knows what kind of a president he might have been. But I think and we'll talk about him and what he was like, but you really go as far as to argue that perhaps had he lived, we might be thinking of him and talking about him as one of the better presidents this country had had.
Well, like you say, it's difficult to know, obviously, because he was only in office for 4 months before he was shot. But I think that it's wrong to dismiss him, and I think it's been, a real tragedy of history that he's been forgotten because he was such an extraordinary man and had really accomplished so much in his time in Congress and as a Civil War veteran with the Union Army, and just as a human being. You know, he was brilliant, he was brave, he was broad-minded, he was progressive. He was all those things that we hope to find in a president.
Yeah, he was all of those things. He was somebody who managed to triumph over being born into extreme poverty. And I think perhaps one of the things that's noteworthy about him is he really believed in the power of education and what that could do for individuals and also what that could do for the country.
He did. You know, education was his salvation. He, as you say, was born into extreme poverty. In fact, he was our last president born in a log cabin. I mean, I'm talking, you know, oiled paper for the windows. He didn't have shoes until he was 4 years old. His father died before he was two. So to put himself through college, his first year, he was a janitor and a carpenter. But by his second year, his sophomore year of college, they had made him a professor of literature, mathematics, and ancient languages. By the time he was 26, he was the university president. He was an extraordinary classicist. He knew the entire Aeneid by heart in Latin. While he was in Congress, he wrote an original proof of the Pythagorean theorem. He was just really, you know, off the charts.
Yeah, and he also was, as you say, was involved in politics in Ohio, where he was born and grew up, and he was in the Congress. And this was at a time when politics was particularly known as a corrupt business, and he seems to really stand out as being someone who was honest and really believed in doing the right thing, no matter what anybody thought.
He did. You know, what? One of his real strengths was the fact that he didn't hunger for any office. In fact, never campaigned for any office. He was in Congress for 17 years, but he never campaigned. You know, people would come to him and ask him to run. In fact, his first position in politics, he was the university president at the Western Reserve Eclectic Institute in Ohio, which is now Hiram College, and a state president or a state senator died, and people came to him and asked him to take the seat. And he did with some trepidation and some concern, but he always made it clear he would not campaign for any seat, and he was always going to follow his own conscience and convictions. And if people didn't agree with him, they shouldn't vote for him. And this was sort of an overriding and overarching theme and an ideal in his life. It was very important to him.
So was it the desire to have him as a candidate, was that because of his involvement in higher education? Did it have something to do with his record having served in the Civil War? What was it about him that people found inspirational and said, well, this is the kind of guy that we ought to have in government?
I think it was all of those things. I think it was widely understood and admired that he had come from such poverty and had raised himself up, you know, not through sort of ambition and hunger for power, but through intelligence and through hard work. And yes, absolutely, during the Civil War, you know, he was a young general, and he had put together a small regiment, and he was asked to fight in what was later known as the Battle of Middle Creek, which was instrumental, was crucial in keeping Kentucky for the Union. And he was made nationally famous through this battle, which he won by fighting a much larger Confederate force, and he was promoted to Brigadier General. So, and in fact, wanted to keep fighting, but Abraham Lincoln himself asked Garfield to come and take his seat in Congress because he needed him more there.
Yeah, there are so many amazing chapters in this story, and one I think of the more amazing is the Republican Convention of 1880, where he becomes the nominee, and he went there to give a speech. He had no intention of being a candidate. He wasn't running for president. He just went to give a speech. And this was at a time when the party was really divided between two factions. One faction on the one hand that was really the status quo faction and was supporting Grant for reelection. And then there was a faction of reformers to which Garfield belonged. It just sort of set the stage of what was going on here and what were people arguing about at that convention.
So this is one of the most extraordinary stories to me that I've ever heard. You know, as you say, Garfield went to this convention not as a candidate, not wanting to be a candidate. He went there to give the nominating address for John Sherman, who was William Tecumseh Sherman's younger brother, was himself from Ohio and was the Secretary of the Treasury under Hayes. And he went into this very vicious fight between these two warring factions, the stalwarts, who were trying to protect patronage, a spoil system, and then the half-breeds, as they were known, who were very progressive, sort of the reformers. And as you say, Garfield belonged to that faction. And it was in this huge hall in Chicago. There were 15,000 people there. And it was incredibly noisy and loud. And Garfield gets up to give his speech, and he begins speaking extemporaneously. And this speech is so beautiful and so powerful that those near him quiet, and it sort of runs through this huge hall and becomes quieter and quieter, and people just become spellbound. They're just riveted by the speech he's giving. And at one point he says, and so, gentlemen, I ask you, what do we want? And someone in the and the crowd shouts, we want Garfield. And the entire hall goes crazy. And when the balloting begins, delegates begin casting their ballots for Garfield, even though he's not a candidate. And he stands up, he objects, but the votes keep coming in. And it sort of builds and builds and builds until there's this flood of votes for him. And before he knows it, he is the Republican nominee for President of the United States.
And that must really have angered the stalwarts, those people who were supporting Grant and who didn't want to see things change.
Absolutely. They were furious. Grant had already served two terms, had, you know, some corruption in his terms, but was still this national hero and was absolutely sort of this iconic figure, especially for the stalwarts. And there was this famous, very, very powerful, very, very corrupt senior senator from New York named Roscoe Conkling, who was very close to Grant and had given Grant's nominating address and believed absolutely Grant would get the nomination. And so he is furious when Garfield gets the nomination, but then he becomes apoplectic when he realizes that he can't control Garfield.
Mm. And here, one of the interesting dimensions is that now the vice president was Chester Arthur, who then went on to become president after Garfield dies. And we can talk some more about Mr. Arthur. But apparently he was a guy who owed his political career completely to patronage and to this man, Conkling.
Completely. He was absolutely Conkling's man. He was absolutely Conkling's political creation. In fact, the only other political office he had had was as the controller of the New York Customs House. And this is Conkling's fiefdom. You know, the New York Customs House controlled 70% of the country's customs revenue. And in that position, Arthur made as much money as the president, and he never showed up for work before noon. You know, this was a sort of a great deal for him, and he was very, very loyal to Conkling. And even after, so he's thrust on Garfield as his running mate, and even after they win the election, he makes it absolutely clear where his loyalties lay. He takes every opportunity to publicly criticize Garfield. He goes on vacations with Conkling. He even lives with Conkling in Washington.
Our guest in this hour, Focus Candace Millard. Her new book is Destiny of the Republic. It's about the life and death of President James Garfield. The book is recently out, published by Doubleday. Quite an interesting story. Gets into a number of areas, American politics, the practice of medicine in this country, science, because amazingly enough, it involves Alexander Graham Bell. We'll talk about that, too. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So let's move on here and talk about the man who shot the president. And again, this is one of those things that, well, if you know anything about James Garfield, you know he was one of those presidents that ultimately dies as a result of someone shooting him, and that if you know anything about this man, Charles Guiteau, the shorthand always in American history is disappointed office seeker.
Right.
Garfield shot by a disappointed office seeker. And one of the things that you say is that's you just that doesn't even in the tiniest bit go on really to tell you about this strange, complicated, mentally ill, and extremely dangerous man, Charles Guiteau. What should we know about him?
That's right. So Charles Guiteau was a deeply, dangerously delusional man. He had tried everything in his life, and he had failed at everything. He was really this sort of mirror opposite of Garfield. They both had come from difficult backgrounds, where Garfield had experienced success after success. However, Guiteau had experienced failure after failure. You know, he had tried law, he had tried evangelism, he had even tried a free love commune, and he had failed even there. The women in the commune had nicknamed him Charles Get Out. And but he continued to have this this incredible delusion of grandiosity. And he when he reads about Garfield's surprise nomination, he decides, okay, I'm going to go campaign for Garfield. I will single-handedly make Garfield president, and out of gratitude, Garfield will make me the consul general to France. You know, he's just completely delusional and becomes obsessed with Garfield. And after Garfield's election, he goes to Washington, and he goes to the White House and the State Department every single day demanding this appointment.
And this has something to say about, and this was one of the things that changed profoundly after Garfield's death, about the presidency and members of the cabinet, people in government, the kind of access there was to them. As I'm sure that what was very frustrating for Garfield and other people who had occupied the office before him is that they had to spend a lot of their time meeting personally with people who wanted something.
That's right. It was extreme. You know, this is the height of the spoils system. So many Americans believe that they are entitled to government positions, even if they don't have any credentials or experience for them. But more than that, they believe that they are entitled to make their case directly to the president himself, and they are allowed to do that. Garfield had to meet with office seekers one-on-one, face-to-face, every day. He had office hours from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. In fact, Charles Guiteau himself walked into the president's office at one point with Garfield in it. And Garfield is miserable with this. You know, he's just desperate for time to work and to think and actually do things for the American people, and he wonders why anyone would ever want to be president.
And not only did Guiteau do this where he would show up at the White House every day and would just hang out looking for opportunities to talk with him, he also maybe haunted other branches of government. It must have been that around Washington, people got to know this man, got to know that he was a nuisance at best. Did anybody think that he actually could have been dangerous?
Yes, people did. You know, he went to the State Department every day. In fact, he once again, it's this incredible thing. He has a one-on-one conversation with the Secretary of State, who has known. You know, he's sort of infamous. You know, people by this point, you know, weeks go by, and people are starting to recognize him and saying, you know, there's Garfield at the White House. Garfield's private secretary says, you know, you need to sort of keep him gently and quietly, keep him away, because you know, he's had these little outbursts. And at the State Department, they're trying to protect this Secretary of State from him. And he goes to a senator from Illinois, and because he lived in Chicago at one point, he actually goes into his rooms at this one hotel and says, look, you need to make sure I get this appointment because I lived in Chicago, and so you're my representative. And so word is getting out that he's a strange and potentially dangerous man, but no one really is doing anything about it.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing you just could not imagine. Mm-hmm. such a thing today would not happen.
Wouldn't happen.
Yeah. So after all of these Guiteau's repeated attempts to get some kind of high government post and repeatedly being rebuffed, how and why did it enter into his head to kill the president?
So another thing about this time, so there's also no Secret Service protection for the president, although this is only 16 years after Abraham Lincoln's assassination. So Garfield walks around the city all the time, absolutely by himself. And one night he leaves the White House. He walks down the street to the Secretary of State's house. They walk along the streets of Washington by themselves with Guiteau following them the entire way, holding a loaded gun. And it was just a week before that that Guiteau, who has become more and more desperate, and you know, he has no job, he has no means of support, so he's more desperate, more delusional, more deranged, he finally has what he believes is a divine inspiration, that God wants him to kill the president, that God wants a stalwart Chester Arthur in the White House. And so it's after this night of following Garfield and his Secretary of State and being angry that they're so close, and the Secretary of State had told Guiteau one-on-one, look, this isn't going to happen, don't talk to me about this appointment ever again. Guiteau goes back to his little boarding house room, and he decides the next time he has an opportunity, he'll take it.
That's, again, just another one of those things you can't imagine in the middle of the night, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton just going for a stroll through Washington in the
That's
middle
right.
of the night. You just think, no, and with no protection. But the other thing that's really quite remarkable, as you point to, is that the fact that it was not that long before that Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated. And you would think that after that experience, people in Washington and people around the president would start thinking that it would be a good idea if there was some more security.
Right. Well, you know, Lincoln's assassination was viewed as a product of war, and Americans thought it would never happen again. You know, there are a lot of assassinations going on in Europe, but Americans thought, you know, that's because they have monarchies there, and those leaders are forced on those people. Here in America, we get to freely choose our leaders, so there's no reason to be unhappy or angry with them, and there should be no danger to the president. In fact, Garfield himself said that assassination can no more be guarded against than death by lightning, and it's best not to worry about either. And so he didn't want anybody. He felt like there were enough restrictions on his life just being president. He didn't want any protection, and the American people didn't believe that he should have any.
And, of course, that was one of the things that changed after Garfield's death.
Well, amazingly, no, it didn't change until 20 years later with McKinley's assassination.
Oh, it took yet another assassination,
yeah.
really, to get people to pay attention.
It's extraordinary to think about it now, but with Garfield's death, you know, the idea was, okay, this was a disappointed office seeker, and it's a fault of the spoils system. And so one of the good things that came about is that Chester Arthur, who was our greatest product of the spoils system, he signed the Pendleton Act, which was sort of the beginning of the end of the spoils system.
Mm. Well, our guest in this, again, hour is Candace Millard. She's author of the book Destiny of the Republic. It's about the life and the death of James Garfield, President James Garfield. And it's published by Doubleday. And questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So after having stalked the president, Guiteau has this idea that God has selected him to assassinate the president so that Chester Arthur can be president. And apparently it must have been that it was the president's schedule, where he would be and when he would be there, pretty much was something that was commonly known. Guiteau knew that that the president was going to be taking a train to go on a little holiday. He knew that station that where he would be. The president had no security, so all Guiteau had to do was just go there and wait for the president to show up, which he did, and then he stepped up and shot him.
He did. As you say, the information is widely available in newspapers at that time, and Garfield goes to the train station with his Secretary of State, no security, and in fact is going to go into the train station by himself, but his Secretary of State says, you know, I think it's unseemly for a president to walk in by himself, so I'll just walk you in. And moments after they walk into the train station, Guiteau steps out of the shadows and shoots the president twice, once in the arm and once in his back, and Garfield's legs buckle. He begins to bleed profusely, vomit violently, and the station just erupts and screams.
Yeah. And here, that's obviously being shot is a serious matter. But here, from this point, the story takes some really strange and sad turns, because, as you explained and as I mentioned right at the beginning, these wounds, while it was serious being shot, need not have been fatal.
Absolutely not. Guiteau's bullet did not hit Garfield's spinal cord. It did not hit any of his vital organs. It went to the left, and it went behind his pancreas, and it later insisted there. And, you know, at this time, there were a lot of Civil War veterans who were walking around with bullets inside of them and doing just fine. In fact, one of the detectives who captured Guiteau had a bullet from the Civil War in his head and, you know, had been functioning fine for years. Unfortunately for Garfield and for the nation, there were ended up being 12 different doctors who repeatedly inserted unsterilized fingers and instruments in the president's back, probing for this bullet.
That's the way that medical history comes into this, because at the time, apparently in Europe, doctors there had accepted the idea that there were germs and that infection was something that you had to take steps to guard against when you were treating people. But in the United States, American doctors, they didn't buy any of that.
That's right. Joseph Lister, who's a renowned British surgeon, had discovered antisepsis 16 years earlier, and he had had dramatic results in his own surgical ward. It had been widely adopted in Europe, and he had come to the United States. He had been invited to be the keynote speaker at a medical congress at our big centennial exposition in Philadelphia in 1876. And he had come there, and he had begged American doctors to sterilize their hands and instruments and warned them that if they didn't, they ran the very real risk of killing their patients. Unfortunately, the older, more experienced, most respected doctors in the United States dismissed antisepsis as useless, even dangerous.
So here we have yet another problem, in that there was this complete disregard for the possibility that probing for the bullet would result in infection, and that was in keeping with what medical practice in the United States was. So those doctors were doing what American doctors would do, unlike what European doctors would do. There was one particular doctor here who emerges, a doctor named Willard Bliss, who apparently got involved in the case through Robert Todd Lincoln, who was the Secretary of War. He was Garfield's Secretary of War, one of Abraham Lincoln's sons. He sent for Bliss after Garfield was shot. I suspect that it was maybe because he knew Bliss, because Bliss had actually been one of the doctors that had attended his dad, his father, Abraham, after he was shot.
Right. So Dr. Willard Bliss, his first name is actually Doctor, which is one of these incredible things. But he had been at Lincoln's deathbed. And so Robert Todd Lincoln knew him. And Robert Todd Lincoln had actually been at the train station as well. This trip that Garfield was going on was sort of part vacation and part work trip. And is stunned and sickened. And he says later, how many hours of sorrow must I spend in this town? And so thinking he can perhaps help, he remembers he has his carriage there, and so he sends for Bliss. And Bliss comes in, and what you have to know about Bliss is he was an incredibly arrogant and ambitious man, and he sees in this national tragedy an opportunity for fame and power, and he seizes control of the president's medical care, even though he has never given that authority. He and a number of other doctors, they examine the president at the train station, and they all go with him to the White House. But there, Bliss absolutely takes control. He dictates a letter to the other doctors saying, the president and I thank you for your efforts up to this point, but they will no longer be necessary, and just dismiss them. And later people start asking, you know, well, why? Who gave Bliss this authority? And he says, oh, you know, I had a private conversation with the president and the first lady. After this comes out, after Garfield's death, and when people start asking questions, and Lucretia says that conversation never took place. So he just takes advantage of the fear and confusion and chaos surrounding this completely shocking presidential assassination attempt to seize control of the president's medical care.
Yeah, and certainly what he hoped was that he would save the president. It would be a glorious medical victory. He would become famous. He certainly, the last thing he would have wanted would have been for Garfield to die.
Absolutely. In fact, he writes this letter on White House stationery to a friend in desperation as the president is worsening, saying, "I can't afford to have him die," underlining each word separately. You know, Bliss, the last thing he wanted was for Garfield to die. He had too much at stake. He works night and day, and at first, everyone thinks the president's going to die that night, because Bliss and a few of the other doctors believe that the bullet is in his liver. But then he survives, and he lives on, and he gets better. Over weeks, he starts to improve. But then he takes this terrible turn because, you know, Garfield is a strong, he's a 6-foot-tall, 210, vigorously healthy young man. He's only 49. And he's fighting off this initial infection. But these doctors are introducing this infection day after day after day, and finally it's too much. You know, Garfield, at the time of his death, he's been starving to death, too. He goes from 210 pounds to 130. He has infection-induced pneumonia in both lungs. He has an abscess that's half a foot in diameter near his liver. He has an abscess on his face that paralyzes his face and then ruptures and fills his mouth and nasal passages with so much pus he nearly drowns. During this time, Bliss is insisting that there's no sepsis, and he refers to the pus as healthy pus. He thinks it's a sign of healing.
In this hour, we're talking with Candace Millard. She is the author of the new book, Destiny of the Republic. It's about the life and death of James Garfield. Also, she wrote an earlier book that a lot of people liked, and it's an interesting story, The River of Doubt, which is about a trip that Theodore Roosevelt took in 1912 down the Amazon. In fact, she talked about that book with Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine back in, I think it was 2005, and that's on our website, too. So if you want to listen to that, you may. And questions are welcome, too, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, back here to the story, and again, another one of these remarkable turns in the story, because we now get to introduce another character. Alexander Graham Bell comes into the story. He apparently, was following, the whole country was following this. And Bell really wanted to help.
He did. So Alexander Graham Bell was this young, restless genius. He was only 34 years old at this time. He had invented the telephone just 5 years earlier, but he had quit the Bell Telephone Company because he wanted nothing to do with this huge company that was growing up around his invention and the 600 lawsuits against it. Bell just wanted to invent, and he wanted to help people. He had lost both of his brothers to tuberculosis before he was 24. Both his wife and his mother were deaf, and he knew that through his inventions, through his ideas, he could help people, he could make life better, maybe even save lives. And so he's quit the company, he's opened this little laboratory in Washington, D.C., and when Garfield is shot, Bell is sickened by the thought of these doctors blindly probing for this bullet, and he thinks science should be able to do better than this, and he comes up with this incredible invention.
And this thing he invented, I guess, essentially what we're talking about, it was a metal detector, and it was something that he had this idea. Well, the problem for the doctors was they had no way of visualizing the bullet. They couldn't really look into Garfield's body and figure out where it was. So he thought, well, okay, we can take advantage of the fact that it's metal and find it. It turned out, well, it didn't turn out well for Garfield. But it did, in fact, turn out that this thing that Bell invented actually worked. And then later on, before the X-ray was invented, it was actually used and did help a lot of people.
That's right. So this is 14 years before the invention of the medical X-ray. And what Bell doesn't realize is he's not just racing against time. He's racing against the president's own doctors. If he can stop them early enough, stop the probing, then Garfield's body might have a chance to fight off this infection. So he invents this induction balance, which is, as you say, is basically a metal detector, which he connects to a telephone receiver. And he works on it night and day in his laboratory and improving it and improving the range of the induction balance. Bliss lets him. Bliss, who's grown very desperate, Bell has contacted him, and Bliss says, yes, you can come to the White House secretly. He goes in through the back door. This is all secret, but he is defeated by the president's own doctors for two reasons. One, the doctors don't tell Bell that the president is lying on something that's very new and unusual at that time, which is a mattress with metal coils, which is, of course, going to affect a metal detector. Two, Bliss believes and has publicly stated that the bullet is on the president's right side, and he will only let Bell search Garfield's right side, but the bullet is on the left.
Yeah. It's just, again, it's a, the twist and turns the story takes are really quite remarkable. And this thing is, this device that he invented, it's on display in a museum in Washington, so you can actually, people can actually see it.
That's right. It's at the National Museum of American History. They have an alcove upstairs that's devoted to presidential assassinations. And the final instrument that Bell used on Garfield is on display there. What a lot of people don't know is that because, you know, Garfield lived for more than 2 months and Bell was working to improve this the whole time, he has, and he's sort of making it up as he goes along because we don't have anything like this. And so in their archives of this museum, they have all the different versions of this instrument that he built, all these different shapes and sizes, and it's just incredible. He donated them to the museum in 1895, and I went there and they brought out box after box, and I just, you know, holding them in my gloved hands, I could just feel, you know, his mind racing and his heart beating, trying to help save this incredible man.
Yeah, and it's just this is interesting because you know, people often, I'm sure people always ask you, they ask other writers, well, how did you come to this story?
Right.
And that for you, you didn't start out wanting to write a story about James Garfield. You started out, you were interested in Alexander Graham Bell.
That's right. Well, you know, as you said at the beginning, and it's true of many Americans and of myself, I knew very little about Garfield beyond the fact that he had been assassinated. And I wasn't necessarily interested in writing about another president. I wanted another subject with science in it. And I was researching Alexander Graham Bell and stumbled upon the story. And, you know, I was so surprised because I had never heard the story before. And I was amazed that Bell, who was at the height of his fame and his power, would turn his life upside down to help Garfield. I mean, he dropped everything he was doing. You know, even he had a family in Boston, two daughters and a pregnant wife, and he had promised them, it was, you know, this is July, it's incredibly hot, and he had promised them they'd be in Maine for the summer, but he said, I'm sorry, you know, I've got to do this, and he threw everything he had into this, and it made me wonder what Garfield was like, and when I realized he was such an extraordinary man, I had to tell the story.
We have about 12-13 minutes left in this part of the show. Again, our guest is Candace Millard. We're talking about her book, Destiny of the Republic, and we have some callers here, so we'll get to them and start out with someone in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you for this fascinating interview.
Is
it Ms. Millard?
Yes.
Who was the Secretary of State who was with the president at the assassination? And after this medical debacle, were any of these doctors hauled into court?
So the Secretary of State was James Blaine, who had been a friend of Garfield's for many years. They had been in Congress together for a long time, and Blaine had then gone on to the Senate, and he had actually been one of these candidates at the convention. He for a long time, had wanted to be president himself, but he becomes Garfield's Secretary of State, and it, you know, is the nation devastated by the shooting and by his subsequent death. No, there are no lawsuits or anything against these doctors. Although Dr. Bliss is publicly disgraced, as soon as the autopsy results are released, the American people know that their president didn't have to die, and they understand why he did. And you wouldn't believe the number of newspaper articles and of articles in medical journals really vilifying these doctors and saying they absolutely should have known better, and this never should have happened. And in fact, one of these articles is titled "Ignorance is Bliss." And so Bliss, he really sacrificed his own medical practice, his own health, to try to save the president. He's disgraced, although he adamantly insists that he not only gave adequate care but exemplary care to the president. In fact, gives Congress a huge bill for his services, which Congress refuses to pay. They pay just a small fraction of it, and Bliss dies just a few years later.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, one of the things that did change as a result of this was, at least I think this is true, that then finally physicians in the United States, American doctors, came to accept what European doctors already thought, that infection was a problem and that you needed to have your instruments and your hands and your everything that you worked with as clean as you possibly could so that this didn't happen to other people.
Absolutely. After Garfield's death, antisepsis is immediately and widely accepted throughout the United States. You know, even during his after his shooting and before his death, there were doctors in the United States who understood that they should be using antisepsis, but those voices weren't heard because they were young doctors who had, you know, studied in Europe, studied Lister's method, but who didn't feel like they could question these older, more experienced doctors. And then there was, you know, I say as someone who lives in Kansas, I proudly say there was a doctor in Kansas who wrote to the First Lady saying, don't let them probe the wound. Make sure they sterilize everything. But again, this is the kind of doctor whose voice is not going to be heard.
To another caller here, Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Ma'am, I called in when you had an interview with Ms. Quinn, and I remembered one of the last questions she asked you was, what's your next project? And you were rather circumspect at that answer. You didn't say, well, I don't know what. Sounds to me you were in the throes of making your mind up at that time. But anyway, the question I was going to ask you about this was that you mentioned that Bliss was at Lincoln's bedside, and he was also at Garfield's bedside. And one of the things that may possibly contributed to Lincoln's death was they were sticking fingers into his brain, too, at the time. I wonder if Bliss was the one doing that also.
That's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't have the answer. You know, if they didn't understand it in 1881 very well, they certainly didn't understand it, you know, at the time of Lincoln's death. In fact, you know, that was just about the time that Lister himself was figuring it out. It was very, very new. So, you know, it's certainly possible. It was quite a tragedy in both cases.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
And something else that's also, it seems kind of incredible. One of my colleagues, my producer, Harriet Wimson, said to me that Robert Todd Lincoln, his father was assassinated, so he was involved in that. He was there when Garfield was assassinated. Apparently also Robert Todd Lincoln was there when William McKinley was assassinated.
He was. It's this dubious distinction. You know, I always say, you know, if you're going to be president, Robert Todd Lincoln is around, you should send him to China or something. You know, it's just this incredible little story of history.
Yeah.
It's true.
Another part here I just want to make sure that we get to, and it looks like maybe we're getting another caller ready to go, is about the effect that all of this had on Chester Arthur, who was the vice president, who then became president. He was he was devastated and horrified with the death of Garfield, and he apparently was so upset that when they came to the door to get him, he didn't even want to come to the door. He was so upset about, presumably, I guess he was upset about the possibility that now he was going to have to be president of the United States.
He was, you know, he was not prepared for that. But more than that, he was genuinely devastated by what had happened to Garfield. You know, Chester Arthur makes this incredible transformation that nobody expected. Even he himself didn't expect. You know, he, after the shooting, he hides himself from view. He refuses to go to Washington for fear that it'll look like he's waiting in the wings. And he cuts himself off from Conkling, the man who made him, to Conkling's rage. And then when Garfield dies, you know, as you say, the reporters rush to Arthur's house for a reaction, and his butler says, you know, you can't see him, and I won't even get a statement from him because he's sitting at his desk with his head in his hands, crying like a child. And what happens is this really extraordinary transformation. Arthur becomes not a great president, but an honest and respected president, and he tries to be the president Garfield would have been had he lived.
That's really, again, a remarkable thing, that here this man who owed his political career to patronage, mm-hmm. to this man Conkling, who was regarded, I think many people in government and in the Republican Party kind of regarded him as a joke, and his being a vice president as being a joke.
Right.
That after all of that being seen that way, that this would have such a transformative effect on him so that he would at least embrace the idea of reform and make some, definitely take some steps in that direction.
Yes, he does. He in fact, he's the person who signs the Pendleton Act, you know, bringing about civil service reform, which is completely what Conkling, and Conkling was absolutely against any type of reform. All he was about was protecting civil service, and Arthur was our sort of greatest product of the spoil system, and so it's just this extraordinary transformation. And he actually, amazingly, he found this moral strength in this very unlikely of places, in the letters of an invalid young woman named Julia Sand, who begins to write to him after the shooting. And these are incredibly eloquent and powerful letters, and Arthur keeps all of these letters. I found them in his presidential papers in the Library of Congress. He keeps them. He writes her back. And after he becomes president, he even goes to see her to thank her in person as president.
Yeah. Well, I have one more caller I want to make sure we get. This is someone who is in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I read River of Doubt, which is just a fascinating, amazing book. I recommend it to anyone who is interested either in Teddy Roosevelt or politics of that era or adventure stories, yeah. Exploration. It's just amazing. But my question today is that I think another twist in this story of the many twists is that The assassin was the first person to use the insanity defense?
He was among the first. It was definitely a new defense, and it was highly controversial. Everyone called it the insanity dodge. And even Garfield himself said, you know, basically it's just a way to get away with murder. But, you know, frankly, if anyone deserved to be found not guilty by reason of insanity, it was Charles Guiteau. He had been insane for a long time. His family had tried to have him institutionalized, but he lived this very solitary and peripatetic life, and he would just slip away. And so he should have gotten help long before he was a danger to anyone, certainly to the president. But the country is so grief-stricken and so enraged that they are determined to see him die. And he is found guilty, and he is hanged.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a sad ending, you know, to that episode. So, well, thank you for your response, and I recommend your books highly. They are,
thank you so much,
eminently readable.
All right. Well, thank you for
thank
the call.
You. Bye-bye.
We're coming down here. We have a couple of minutes left, and here through the course of the conversation, we've talked about the various ways in which Garfield's death and the circumstances and how this story developed, changed things. Well, certainly one of the things, and we talked earlier about Garfield and the fact that at that time the president was a very accessible individual, and he was expected to spend hours and hours every day meeting personally with people who wanted jobs and who wanted favors and who wanted something. And that among the things that changed was after this, the president was no longer his office was no longer open in the way that it had been before.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It absolutely changed a lot of things. You know, it changed medical science through antisepsis, which saved countless lives. It helped bring about civil service reform. In fact, even before the shooting, Garfield had said enough of these office hours and had drastically cut them back just so he could have time to do his job. And you know, it really sort of changed the fabric of the nation. You know, Lincoln's assassination had only deepened the divide between North and South after the Civil War. But Garfield was really the first president since the Civil War to be accepted as a leader of the whole country, North and South. And he was trusted by, you know, pioneers, by immigrants, freed slaves. He had been a fierce abolitionist. He had been instrumental in bringing about black suffrage while he was in Congress. And also, you know, trusted by former slave owners. And so he was this rare person who was sort of one of our own because he had come from such humble origins. But he, through his rise and through his honesty, through his character, was sort of what we aspire to be as a people, as a nation, and symbolized so much of this hope and promise that he, you know, not completely and not without imperfections, brought the country back together. I mean, obviously we had a lot of growing pains to go through, but they, you know, this was our loss as a nation, and our common grief for this time brought the country together.
Yeah. Well, just we're at the point here, we have to finish. We have about a minute. I believe that after having written the book about the Roosevelt book, you thought, well, I don't really want to become known as someone who just writes about presidents, and you didn't go on to write about Garfield. As you explained, you were interested in writing about science, and we're looking at the life of Alexander Graham Bell. But now you have written two books that in large part are about American presidents. On behalf of the man who called in earlier who asked about, well, what's next, do you have some thoughts about what your next project might be?
I do. I do have a contract for my next project, and I can't talk in detail about it, but I can say that it's going to be a small and what I hope a sort of personal and illuminating story, I hope, about Winston Churchill.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, people can read Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. That's the new book by our guest Candace Millard, M-I-L-L-A-R-D. It's published by Doubleday. Also, folks, I'm sure, would also enjoy reading The River of Doubt, her book that was all about Teddy Roosevelt and a trip that he made down the Amazon in 1912. That book was really well reviewed, and a lot of people enjoyed it, and folks might like looking at that, too. And Ms. Millard, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the program. Appreciate it.
And you've been listening to a show from the Focus Archives. This is a program we first brought to you in October. All of our programs are on the web, at least a lot of them are. If you'd like to go back and listen to some past shows, just stop into our website. It is will.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
In the next hour, we'll also go to the archives for a program that looks back to the events that took place in the summer of 1981 when the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization called a strike. It was an illegal strike. Ronald Reagan, the president, just a few months actually into his first term, ordered them back to work. Most of them refused, and Reagan fired them. This was the beginning of a long period of decline for organized labor in the United States. We go to the archives in hour two for a conversation with historian Joseph McCartan. His book Collision Course tells the story of the Patco strike and also explains how the events of 30 years ago changed labor politics in America. That is coming up in the next hour of Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony, presenting Classics 2, Dances and Romances, featuring Stefan Milenkovich, violin, on Saturday, January 28th at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts.
Maybe just a quick mention of Friday on the program. We'll be back on the regular schedule. We'll have live guests. We'll take calls. In the first hour, we will talk with Ellen Langer. She's professor of psychology at Harvard University, an artist, a writer, very well known for the concept of mindfulness, something that people will recognize from Buddhist practice, but also something that psychologists are interested in. The fact that we can live so much more, such a full life, a fuller life than we do now, by really paying much more attention to what's going on in our lives and going on around us. That's hour one. Then hour two, we will talk about Haiti and the effort to rebuild there now 2 years after a devastating earthquake. The guest will be Laurent Dubois. He teaches at Duke and is the author of a recent book, Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. So that's on Friday. Right now, we'll take a break, as we usually do, to bring you an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Auditory Care Center, an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul.
At 10:59, this is Jeff Bosser with a look at the markets at this hour. Kansas City hardware winter wheat for March, 708.5, up 11.5. For May, 17, up 11.25. In Chicago, March wheat, 656, up 14.5. May, 667.75, up 11.5. March corn, 640.75, up 6.25. May, 646, up 5.75. July, 649.5. That's up 5.5. September, 593, up 6. March crude oil, 163. That's up 123. March beans, 12.28 1/4, up 14.75. May, 12.37 1/4, that's up 14.5. July beans, 12.47, up 14.5. August, 12.